Hey guys, so unfortunately we had a little bit of technical difficulties recording this episode, so it's not the best audio, but we think the episode's really good.
Yeah, so just listen and we hope you enjoy it.
Yo, Nicole.
What's up?
When you think of fairy tales that Disney has adapted, what comes to mind?
First one that usually pops into my mind is Cinderella. What about you?
Usually for me, probably Beauty and the Beast.
Really?
Yeah. You know what? I think that was one of the first Disney movies I ever saw. And coincidentally, it's going to be the topic that we'll be talking about today.
Really?
Yeah, we'll be talking about Disney's Beauty and the Beast from 1991 and 2017's Beauty and the Beast. I'm Rolando.
And I'm Nicole.
And this is Remakes, Reboots, and Revivals, an original podcast
about unoriginality. Good job.
Got it. So what's up, Nicole? How's your day going?
I'm good. I'm excited for Christmas.
You're doing some time traveling there, Nicole. I love it.
Well, I mean, it doesn't matter what time of year it is. I'm always excited for Christmas.
Oh, fair. I'm always excited for Halloween.
So, see? Yeah, that's holidays.
My holiday of go-to. I love Christmas. Don't get me wrong. But
yeah,
usually, I actually think, do people consider Beauty and the Beast a Christmas movie? Because there's a Christmas element, the snowy point.
Yeah, there's something strange. That whole number, that isn't whole, that yeah, like
that
Christmas?
That whole scene takes place at night, yeah. At Christmas.
True. And usually movies like that, like the big Disney releases, get released around like the holiday season.
Yeah, most certainly. Well, that's the most money to be made.
Mm-hmm.
So, spoiler alert, guys, we're talking about Beauty and the Beast today.
Much excited. And as always, today we are joined by Josh and Eddie Z together for the first time.
You guys are our guests. Our guests.
Be our guests.
You guys are ridiculous.
We are here again, yes.
I thought that was cute. Whatever.
That was adorable.
So, Nicole, as usual, give me a breakdown of history.
Yeah, let's do some time traveling. Let's step back into 26 whole years ago. That's the music for Beauty and the Beast, right? Yes. See, Eddie Z's shaking his head, saying
oh,
yes.
Oh, that was. That's like that's the castle music, right?
Yeah. Let me remind some people who don't know what happened that year. In 1991, George H.W. Bush was president. Pretty much the Cold War was ending, but then the new war was beginning of the Gulf War. So chaotic times. And in music, songs like Everything I Do It For You was like at the top of the charts. Also, That's Me in the Corner. This is like the songs that people were hearing on the radio.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then in the movies, people were going to go see movies like Terminator 2, Judgment Day, and Hook. Really cool, epic movies. They also, on November 22nd, 1991, saw the release of one of Disney's most epic films, Beauty and the Beast. Beauty and the Beast was an old fairy tale written by Jean-Marie Le Prince de Beaumont, a French fairy tale. In 1946, it was adapted by the great Renaissance man Jean Cocteau as a film. In 1991, it was adapted into a musical by Disney. Now, this is during an age in which Disney had a big comeback. Now, I don't know if you remember, but in the late 70s and the early 80s, after Walt Disney died, they went through different management.
Yeah, I think it was an identity crisis.
They had a bit of an identity crisis. They were like, what kind of movies do we want to make? Wait, what is the point of Disney again? Like, they didn't have any guidance. And they were making movies that are really good. Some of my favorites, like Robin Hood. And Fox and the Hound and Oliver Company and the Rescuers, but
the Black
they just
Cauldron,
weren't...
which is like the black sheep of all Disney movies.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so but like these films just weren't drawing the attention of audience goers. Mm-hmm. But in 1989, The Little Mermaid came out, and everyone was there. Everyone was into it. It had everything. It had a really good story. They hired Broadway composers to write the score, and this was all under the guidance of the new chief executive officer of Walt Disney Company, Michael Eisner.
Oh, Michael Eisner.
Yes, Michael Eisner. He brought in this new wave of the Disney Renaissance, and the films that came out were Little Mermaid, 1989, Beauty and the Beast, 1991, Aladdin, 1992, which is the first movie I ever saw in theaters, and then 1994 is The Lion King. And they were just like, Disney could do no harm. And then the next year, Toy Story came out and began the Pixar revolution. So that's a little bit of historical. That's all we need. We are all very familiar with Beauty and the Beast. There's not a lot I can tell you.
Yeah.
And I don't want to like bore you with the minute details or anything, but like that's just a little bit of background.
I think a lot of especially people in our age, so we're in our 30s, right? Like, that's this is prime childhood.
I'm 29.
You're 29? Okay, I think we had this. Well, even though you still fall under millennial.
Yes.
This is prime millennial nostalgia right here.
Yeah.
Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, you know, that Disney Renaissance era. So it, you know, it makes sense that why we'll be talking about this today. Mm-hmm. So what do you remember, anything that stands out from Beauty and the Beast for you, Nicole?
I just remember seeing this movie all the time on the on my VHS player. I had a book of it. I still remember how that book smells. I was obsessed with this. Listened back to the tape. And I really loved it. Out of all the movies, it was the one I was gravitating to. Instead of The Little Mermaid, I always kind of never really liked The Little Mermaid. And Aladdin was fun, Lion King, but I liked Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, no. Beauty and the Beast, I think, is, for me, at least most memorable only because of the camera work for an animated film. Okay. I guess I'm just jumping right into it, but I think one of my favorite parts of that movie was actually the ballroom dance. Mm-hmm. And, from learning some film history, that was one of the earliest adaptations of computer animation in filmmaking.
True.
They couldn't render out the ballroom itself just by hand drawing. So Disney took a big risk with going the computer animated route because no one had done it, at least for animation, for a feature length yet.
Yeah.
And, I think that's one of the reasons why this movie, I think, stands the test of time. Its animation feels so seamless. The camera work, the colors, it was just all so pretty.
Well, I mean, also, I forgot to mention this, but Beauty and the Beast was the first animated film to be nominated for Best Picture.
Oh,
I mean,
right.
When it came out, it was very critically acclaimed. And people recognized the achievements that you're talking about. And then it was just a really good story.
Yeah.
So it didn't win. Silence of the Lambs won that year.
It won best song, right? I want to say with Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Celine Dion and I forget the other guy.
I mean, the cover was sung by
the cover?
Dion and Peeble Bryson, but in the movie,
it's
sung by Angela Lansbury.
Right. But I think the one that counts is what's it called?
No, the one that counts is Angela Lansbury.
I don't think so. No.
What are you talking about? Okay, first of all.
Sorry.
Bobby has an opinion about that, and I think Bobby was on my side.
Bobby needs a mic.
But recently, Lincoln Center held like a 25th anniversary Beauty and the Beast. I guess, what was that, like 2 years ago or something? And, you know, there's Alan Menken. He's there on the piano. Mm-hmm. And he starts playing, do, 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 mm-hmm. do. Angela Lansbury walks out.
Tale as old as time. True as it can be.
Not a dry eye in the house.
Yeah.
When you grow up and you watch that movie, you're out of the room by the time the end credits are on and you hear Celine Dion and Peeble Bryson. But you invested in that scene. And when you hear Mrs. Potts singing that song.
You got me there.
Whether or not you like the movie, like I have problems with the movie and all this stuff. But like that song, it hits me close to home. And you bet your butt that if you were to put that on right now, I'm going to start bawling my eyes out.
So
interesting enough.
as much as I love the scene, the song, I never connected much with the song. Mm-hmm. In fact, the song that I connected with the most was Gaston's song. Gaston.
No one's quick as Gaston. No one's next as incredibly thick as Gaston. For there's no man in town half as manly. Perfect up your
time. So that song, I think for me, was way more fun. I think it was catchier. It was a lot more... It was silly. It was just a fun song,
definitely really silly.
You know, you have Gaston there showing off who he is. Oh, that one and Be My Guest.
Be Our Guest.
Is it Be Our Guest? I thought it was Be My Guest.
Oh, Be My Guest. No, you're thinking of See My Vest from The Simpsons.
Be Our Guest. That's another one. That's like the equivalent of Under the Sea, I guess, with The Little Mermaid, right?
Yeah, but a way better song. Under the Sea is one of the most annoying songs that I've ever heard in my life.
Oh, we disagree here.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I guess
the moment I hear like do 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 do.
It's like every.
I'm like, okay, I'm leaving.
I guess famously during the Disney Renaissance, every song has that. Every film had that kind of weird, annoying song that was.
Yeah, that was kind of like the fun upbeat song.
Hakuna Matata, I think for
Prince Ali, fabulous.
Which is actually my favorite song.
Yeah.
Be Our Guest. That's another one. That's like the equivalent of Under the Sea, I guess, with the Little Mermaid, right?
Yeah, but a way better song. Under the Sea is one of the most annoying songs that I've ever heard in my life.
Oh, we disagree here.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I guess I'm
going to hear like...
It's like every...
I'm like, okay, I'm leaving.
I guess famously during the Disney Renaissance, every song has that... Every film had that kind of weird, annoying song that was...
Yeah, that was kind of like the fun upbeat song.
Hakuna Matata, I think for...
Prince Ali, Fabulous.
Which is actually my favorite song also.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, though, because we're talking about, like, what we remember from the movie. But when I think about this film and, like, the time period that it came out and how people received it, I think they were just, like, so starved for what a lot of them were getting back in the day when Disney was alive, when Walt Disney was alive, when they were making films like Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty, that big, epic, classic fairy tale musical again. Mm-hmm. And so Beauty and the Beast, more than The Little Mermaid, ushered in that kind of classic, traditional Disney film. Yeah. And that's why I think it was so widely received when it first came out. And then I think for us, when we watched it as just like little kids, there was a lot that was going on that we hadn't seen in Disney films before then, which is kind of like a strong female character and someone who like sticks up for herself. And it's actually, she has in her own way, kind of an adventure.
Yes.
And it brings your imagination to life. So there's a lot of those elements going on. So for the older people, it's bringing back this sense of nostalgia of like why they loved Disney in the first place. And then for us, when we were growing up watching it, we were just like, whoa, she's talking to a candlestick, man. We were really high when we were kids, apparently. No, but like it definitely, it's very imaginative and it also, I have problems with it. But before I get into that.
You know. Yeah, I guess we're just giving our praises before we get into... I don't know if I have any real problems with the film, even in retrospect. Even in being a learned MFA student, you know, graduate. I don't think... I understand some of the problems that people have. Like, you know, I think the usual comparison that this one gets is like... If you had to, like, give this one a one-word title, it's basically Stockholm Syndrome, right?
That's a two-word title.
Well, a different title, right? And, usually people go to, this is a Stockholm Syndrome story, right? He kidnaps her and she ends up falling in love with your captor.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to have to give my feminist twist on this in the sense where it's like, I do have a problem with the fact that, you know, this is a movie, along with almost every other like princess fairy tale movie that Disney has ever made that kind of, except for perhaps Frozen, which is, you know, an exception to the rule. They're finally changing the way they do princess movies. But where, you know, girls pretty much, whenever they go through something alone and in isolation. They don't have a buddy with them. And if they do have a buddy, it's an animal or it's an inanimate object. And then it could be, like, argued that it's all in this girl's head or whatever. But she goes through it alone. She's forced into isolation. Nobody understands her. You know, like, she's always the outcast. Belle is the outcast.
Right.
Ariel was the outcast.
Yeah.
Who else? Cinderella was the outcast.
Yeah.
So, and then, like... These young girls grow up like, well, you know, nobody understands me. No, I don't know what it's like. And from my own misery and my own isolation, I need to be saved by a Prince Charming. And I don't like that message that girls are being subconsciously fed in their youth. And then my other problem is that in the movie, after the whole introduction and that horrible spell is put on a young boy, presumably, if you do the math,
he, according to Be Our Guest, they mentioned the lyrics, like, it's been 10 years that they've been under the spell, so he's supposed to be 21 when the spell ends, like, when he dies. So he was 11 when the spell was cast upon
him. So some, like, fucking bitter, salty enchantress shows up and puts a spell on an 11-year-old.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I'm sorry, the 11-year-old spoiled child who is a prince is, you know, not a nice person. Like, who would have known?
They corrected that in the remake, though, and I'm not going to harp too much on that, but in the remake, I have more of a problem with it because you're a man of like, a certain age, so you should know better. And we're going to cover that when we get to it. But why, like, they end it with, for who could ever learn to love a beast? And I'm like, why does someone need to learn to love a beast? Why can't he learn to love himself? And then, like, nobody has to learn to love him. And it's just like, he learned how to be a better person because that's how the spell got put on him in the first place.
Right.
You know, so hello.
So I'm here. I'm going to disagree with you a little, though. I don't think Belle was one of those few exceptions where she wasn't rescued, per se. She was kidnapped by the beast because, I don't know, that was a deal that she cut with the beast to protect her father. But at the end of the day, like, she kind of was the one who put herself in that situation just so that way her dad didn't have to, like, live out that sentence, right?
Yes.
She was also the one who was able to look past the beast's icy horrendousness to fall in love with him and stuff. And she was also the one who, I mean, she was teaching him how to read because, what's it called? The kid was illiterate. He was an illiterate prince.
Yes, there are exceptions to it that make it different than, say, Cinderella or something else, but it still is teaching young girls that, regardless.
I don't think it was necessarily teaching young girls that they had to wait for the prince because, in this case, it was just like,
Exceptionally bright, gifted girl who reads a lot, and yet you're gonna, you know.
But at least it was teaching girls that, like, you know, to be a little different, like, as opposed to. So I think with the Little Mermaid, she was more prone to, like, just waiting around for, you know, she was just waiting for. Even she wasn't waiting for the prince to come and save her. Like, she was just waiting to get into that part of that world.
No, she gave up her voice for a boy.
She did. All right, fine. She gave up her voice for a
and
boy.
And her family and her life. And she still, at the end of it, chose it, like, that life over her family, who she never appreciated and felt isolated from for her own reasons.
But you're right. But here's the thing. She has choices. I mean, these are the women are making the choices.
Yes.
I think, as opposed to the earlier Disney films where they were being rescued, they were put in precarious situations by forces outside of
their doing, right? Yes, Snow White and Sleeping Beauty in particular.
Like, at least these protagonists in these new Disney movies, specifically Beauty and the Beast.
The Renaissance ones.
Right. They were the ones who were putting themselves in these situations. They were more proactive, at least. And at the end of the movie, like, she didn't. Sure, she ends up with the prince now that he's beautiful and spells him broken. Mm-hmm. But she wasn't rescued at any point. Like, she didn't get saved by him. She was the one who actually saved him.
Yes,
because he needed her to break the spell.
Well, you could argue that, like, when people fall in love, two people are like, "You saved me from myself," and like all that lovey-dovey mentality. Every Disney movie gets better.
Mm-hmm.
With the portrayal of women, but it's still somewhat there. Like, comparing it from 1991's Beauty and the Beast to 2013's Frozen, there was a big improvement in the depiction of women and, sure, like, other relationships and, like, what a true love's kiss was that could break a spell.
Right.
You know, direct correlation there. So by 1991 standards, it was better.
Right.
And this is also ushering in the 90s feminism, you know? In the 80s, feminism wasn't a thing as much, and it was brought back in the 90s. And 90s was a big era for feminism.
Okay.
But this was also, like, the beginning of that.
Mm-hmm.
You even said that she suffers from Stockholm Syndrome. So, like, even though she's not rescued, I'm not saying that. Victimized.
That's what the joke is usually. That
well,
she
would you
was.
Agree with that joke?
I mean, she was so strong-headed. It wasn't Stockholm Syndrome, I guess. Like, yeah, okay. It's just she was stuck in the castle with him, but she'd been made friends with, you know, she had other people to connect with, you know, Lumiere,
She had inanimate objects to connect with that could have very well been in her head.
The souls of people were in those inanimate objects. So she's still making connections.
What a it's still curse.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't know why, you know, these people got lucky with their names because they were able to, like, find the objects that best relate to them.
Yeah.
But no, I don't know if I would classify it as Stockholm Syndrome. I feel like she wasn't in the castle long enough to develop Stockholm Syndrome.
Stockholm Syndrome is not about how long you're there for. It's about whether or not they have power over you to make you forget about the fact that they took you prisoner and that you're there, like, being victimized, and now you fall in love with this person and you forget all the cruel things that they did to you and the circumstances that you're under.
But he let her go. He let her go. And then she went off, and then she realized, I miss him.
After he realized she was suffering the effects of Stockholm Syndrome.
I don't know. Well, you know, I don't know. I just don't think it was Stockholm Syndrome. I just think, all right, fine.
She's one of the best, and she's one of the brightest of the princesses, for sure. She's my favorite. I love her.
Yeah.
Likes to put her head in a book and all that stuff. But at the same time, it's not actually her. It's just Disney's portrayal of women in general. But other than that, I mean, I like the movie. Although I do have a problem. I really have a problem with the beginning. Like, the moment the movie begins and it says, "For who could ever learn to love a beast?" I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, I don't like that mentality. Why does somebody have to learn? He needs to be the one to do the learning and the reflecting, and nobody has to adjust to him. It should be the other way around.
Well, I agree with you there. I think the beast himself just didn't do any. He was just angry.
Yeah.
He
spent 10 years and he's still angry. What kind of learning did you do in 10 years?
I don't know. Would you not be angry, though, if you were turned into a hideous beast?
You remember that movie Groundhog Day?
Yes.
Let's assume that Bill Murray went through, like, 5 years of the same day. He spent reliving the same day for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Half the time that the beast is alone and not reliving the same day. And by the end of that, he turned his life around.
Yeah, all right, fine. But if that's going to be the case.
I mean, I don't know how that made my point, but it makes sense. But, but those are just the mini qualms I have with it. So I'm
trying to think if I have any actual qualms with the film. No, actually, I generally don't. I don't look at, I guess, Disney movies with a feminist slant. Or
you should try learning. You should do it.
Not necessarily feminism or even with looking at it through my queer identity either. Just because I feel like the target, there's something about watching a kid's film and just letting it be just that, I think.
Well, you know, it's interesting though, because this one has a lot of really heavy sexual undertones to it with the candlestick and the dust.
Mrs. Featherbottom? I don't think that's her name. But
well, we'll just call her right. that. And then with, Gaston and wanting to manhandle and possess Belle.
Right.
And so it's okay, then if we're going to let it be a kids movie, then are we going to have problems with the fact that there are some strong sexual undertones there? And are you okay with your kid realizing that? I mean, seeing that, if I were to have seen this film, I saw Aladdin the next year, which was also highly sexual undertones.
Aladdin
I was
is,
4 years old.
Aladdin, I remember, was definitely hyper. Because Aladdin, he basically, they imply that he just has sex. Yeah. He's a street rat,
Yeah.
As all street rats do.
He's got his shirt off the whole movie.
Yeah.
He's wearing a vest.
That's something. I don't think he's a vest.
Oh, he's wearing a vest. So he covers up.
I think you guys are reading way too much. I saw these as a child and I was not reading sex into all these things. Mrs. between Lumiere and Mrs. Featherbottom, but only I saw that, I guess, through the context of what was that? The Pepe Le Pew and that feline character.
Warner Brothers, Looney Tunes.
Right? Yeah, through the Looney Tunes. Pepe Le Pew was he was a Frenchman. Oh, well, and Lumiere is a Frenchman.
Yeah.
I guess it's more this is more just racism.
Oh yeah, well that was also 1940s cartoons that were meant for all ages in parentheses.
Even looking at it through rose-colored glasses of nostalgia, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. I just never really. It's hard for me to put, and I don't know if this is maybe because it's a product of me just feeling so young and innocent and not even comprehending these things, but. The over-sexualization of these characters, it never once crossed my mind. I don't think I thought of it as a child. I don't know if I'm going to play this movie with my child, they're going to look at it that way. If they are looking at it that way, then that says more about how you're raising these kids than anything.
Okay, you're also ignoring the subconscious effects that these things have on us. Mm-hmm. You might not be aware of what you're digesting, but you're processing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, subliminal messagery is a thing. And subliminal messaging is pretty much where you're watching something and you're receiving a message and you don't know you're watching. You're receiving it. This is actually more on the nose than a subliminal message. It's just children is particular. You never saw it when you were a kid because you weren't digesting it, but in the obvious way, but you were. And it did have an impact on you. Let's bring up Gaston, right?
Sure.
Do you feel any sort of sexuality from Gaston? Or look at him in any sort of sexual way. And I'll use myself as an example. Jessica Rabbit in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, I view in a very sexual light. And maybe when I saw it when I was 4 or 5 years old, I wasn't processing it then. But, I process it now. And I realize what I felt back then.
So I would agree with you on Jessica Rabbit. But I think Jessica Rabbit had more, the audience was a little bit different from the
extreme case, yes, but
yeah, that was
but all the princes are shirtless and muscular and handsome. And
I don't know, was Gaston shirtless in the film? I think he did take off his shirt for her, right? Yeah, and for the three hoes that follow him around everywhere, right?
And yeah, sexual right there. Oh, yeah, the three hoes. Hello, you grasped that much.
Well, I'm grasping that in retrospect.
Well, yeah, but you also are somewhat processing that as a child,
sure. All right, I agree with you there. Wow, I guess this movie is way more problematic than I realized growing up.
Which is why we can't just look at things and be like, oh, it's a children's film, that's it, because you never know what it is you're digesting. It's like when you put something on in the background, but then 2 hours later you remember it, or you're like, did I see that in a movie or somewhere? And it's like, you're still processing that information.
Right.
You know? Like, you're not doing it at 100% because you're not glued to the television, but you're processing that information. So that's why I think it's actually important. And it's interesting, though, because in the remake, which we're going to get to in a bit, they really addressed sexuality.
All right. So, yeah. So I think that's a excellent segue to enter the 2017 version of Beauty and the Beast. Currently, right now, we're living in an era where Disney is adapting a lot of these original, a lot of their original animated features and turning them into live action films. First started off with 2000's Alice in Wonderland by Tim Burton. Then it was followed by Maleficent, which is more of a retelling, reimagining. And that was followed by Cinderella, which was actually more of your classical remake. And then the Jungle Book, which was actually one of my favorite remakes. And now we're here with 2017's Beauty and the Beast. It was directed by Bill Condon, who directed, I guess most famously, Dreamgirls, which was a musical, and Breaking Dawn, the Twilight series, 1 and 2. So interesting choices here, right? As, you know, this movie starred who? Emma Thompson as Belle. You had Luke Evans
Emma Watson.
I said Thompson. Emma Thompson was Mrs. Potts. Yeah. That's who she was. Emma Watson was Belle. Once again, my mistake with names, guys.
Little town, it's a quiet village. Every day like the one before. Little town.
I mean, for 2017, like, it was, I think, the highest grossing film, at least maybe worldwide. The highest grossing film of the year was actually, what's it called? Star Wars, The Last Jedi.
What number was Beauty and the Beast?
Number 2.
Ah, in 1991, Beauty and the Beast was number 3.
Wow, so the live action did better. I think that's also probably because of the, you had to pay for 3D glasses here.
Yeah, and inflation and all that stuff, yeah.
Some of the other ones in the list were Fast and Furious, Despicable Me, Spider-Man, Guardians of the Galaxy, Thor, and Wonder Woman was also in that list. One of the only few other female lead roles in.
So I'm gonna now say the films that were the top 10 grossing films of 1991.
Why?
And there's gonna be such similarities because the similarities are actually
similar.
Are similar.
Go on.
8 was Cape Fear, which was a remake.
Oh, I didn't know Cape Fear was a remake.
Mm-hmm. 7th was The Addams Family, which was an adaptation, kind of a remake of the TV show.
Okay.
6th was JFK. Hmm. 5, Silence of the Lambs. Hook, an offshoot kind of thing about Peter Pan, right? So referencing another body of work there. 3, Beauty and the Beast. 2, mm-hmm. Robin Hood. Like, my God, what is that? The 4th adaptation of Robin Hood into a movie? This is the Kevin Costner one?
No, Kevin Costner must have been like 3rd. I think, wasn't Guy Ritchie's most recently one of those?
I'm talking, but in 1991 it was, because there was the 1939 Errol Flynn one, when there was the 1973 Disney one, and there was definitely a silent film version of it. So that was the 4th.
Gotcha. All right, okay, fine.
Okay.
Sorry. Forgot who I was talking to.
And then the first one is Terminator 2 Judgment Day. So you see a lot of sequels, and you see a lot of things that are based off of material that is just, it's not original. Mm-hmm. There was like 3 original films on the list or so. And it's just not that different from this day and age. And also, where's the lack of, I mean, there's not that much women representation. Beauty and the Beast and Silence of the Lambs is the best we can do on that. So it's just like eerie, the similarities, because we're like, we're a culture that's obsessed with remakes and reboots. And yet it's not that different, actually. In 1991, we were still kind of into that, too.
No, yeah. I mean,
and that, sequels and all that.
This has been a Hollywood trend forever.
You know, so it's just like, so why do you think they remade it in 2017, other than the fact that they're doing this trend, why Beauty and the Beast? Because this has sparked a brand new trend, hasn't it?
I think more so for Beauty and the Beast might have been the success of Cinderella.
Okay.
Where you had like the classic princess story. Because I think the what they saw. So Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland, we can discount that as part of being, you know, kind of that. I would discount that as being part of that canon of like those Disney remakes, mm-hmm. Even though it was a loose adaptation of both the book and the original, not the original, but the Disney film, right? Then you have Maleficent, which was the reimagining, right? So they took the Sleeping Beauty story and just retold it through the perspective of Maleficent and kind of changed things up. I think when they decided, it's just like, oh, people are responding to these kind of live action stories. When they decided to redo Cinderella, I think there was a lot of excitement. I remember when the teaser first dropped, and you know, Cinderella is not like the first Disney princess, but I think she's one of the more popular ones, because I think her stories are so it was such an elegantly told story. The animation was gorgeous. You had the glass slipper, Prince Charming. You know, had all the elements that you want as a child, as a
abused young girl, isolated from her family. Well, of course, all the classic elements.
Of course,
longing for a man to save her.
Right, this one she was. And
No mother figure, an evil mother figure.
Man, Disney, really. And right, so I think because of the success of Cinderella, Disney decided it's just like people are responding to these movies. Let's try what I would consider there. I think Cinderella is probably, like, I know for me, Cinderella, that's not the first princess I think of. I said it was Belle. But Cinderella will probably be after. I think for most people, when people think of Disney princesses, they actually think of Cinderella first. You know, when you go to Disney World, right? For example, you have the Cinderella castle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's not Snow White's castle, it's Cinderella's castle.
Wait. In Disney World or Disneyland? In Disney World. Oh, what's Disneyland?
I think that's
Sleeping Beauty's castle.
I think it is Sleeping Beauty's. Well, hang on. Not Sleeping Beauty. I don't really think that much of Sleeping Beauty. No one knows. Does anyone know her name?
Aurora.
Oh, you know it? It took me decades to learn her name. I did not know. I just knew her as Sleeping Beauty.
Well, I know her because she's my favorite because she's actually the only one who's like completely victimized the whole time. And she's just trying to live her best life. And everyone in her life is lying to her and conspiring either for or against her. Poor thing. We'll just leave her that alone for now. But,
I think it was a natural progression to go right from, oh, well, Maleficent was Sleeping Beauty, right? So that's already their three main princesses that they're doing. So it makes sense that they would try to go for Beauty and the Beast, if only for the yellow gown. Well,
true, but this is, okay, so it's interesting, though, because this one is like, technically it's an adaptation of the Broadway musical. In 1994 or 5, they made it the Broadway musical adaptation of the film.
That's true,
of 1991's Beauty and the Beast.
So Disney was working on the adaptation of the Broadway musical for a while, and then it just kind of fell apart. They just like...
No. I mean, they did it.
No. They did the music. They did the musical itself. But they won in 1990, in the mid 90s. They were trying to adapt that into a film.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was trying to go. That was getting speed tracked into an actual film, and it just never came into fruition.
Yeah.
Once Disney started doing these adaptations, it was when Disney kind of decided, like, let's see what we can do with Beauty and the Beast. Originally, it was actually not going to be done as a musical. It was actually the head of production for Disney Studios that was the one who pushed it to become a studio. So I actually have a quote here from him that I think is kind of telling.
Oh, can you put on a voice too?
I don't know what Sean Bailey sounds like, but...
Just make it up. Do Jimmy Stewart.
Well, this is Sean Bailey here telling you something you should know.
That's Sean Connery. All right, hang on. I'm trying to think.
That's not Sean Connery.
Isn't that Sean Connery? That wasn't Sean. Who was that?
That's my Jimmy Stewart. Hey, movie house. You can't just buy people, Mr. Potter. Come on, that's Jimmy Stewart.
I don't know who Jimmy Stewart is.
Oh, my God.
Wow, really?
It's not Sinister looking good, Grace.
That's right. We were literally just talking about this. No.
Yeah.
Yeah, guys, not film history, film names. No, not like big names.
Oh, my God.
In film history, not really my thing.
Oh, my God.
But anyway, I'll go to this quote from Sean Bailey. He was the head of production for Disney Studios. We worked on this for 5 or 6 years and 18 months to 2 years. Beauty was a serious dramatic project, and the scripts were written to reflect that. It wasn't a musical at that time, but we couldn't get it to click. It was Alan Horn who championed the idea of owning the Disney of it all. We realized there was a competitive advantage in the songs. What was wrong with making adults feel like little kids again?
You know, that right there, what was wrong with making adults feel like little kids again, is so telling as to why the film was made.
Absolutely.
We are in an era where we're obsessed with the 90s because it's our age group who grew up in the 90s. And now we're the people who are out there buying. And we're like, we're the key demographic.
Yeah.
We're 21 to 35. We're millennials. We grew up in the 90s and the culture of the 90s. And we're just overly obsessed with the 90s. So they're like, it's only natural that we remake all the 90s films because all the 90s kids, because they're just so nostalgic for the time period they grew up with, are going to go to the theater and see the 90s remake. So it's this really interesting time period we're living in.
I mean, I know we millennials tend to be very nostalgic, but it also has, it's more, I'm thinking more capitalistic here.
It's 100% capitalistic.
Well, no, but we're at the age, it's not just nostalgia, we're also the age bracket where we have the disposable income.
I'm saying they're profiting off of nostalgia.
They're most certainly profiting off of it. But I'm just saying, it's just like, I don't think they're exploiting the nostalgia. They're not exploiting nostalgia because we're nostalgic. They're exploiting nostalgia at our right now because we're that age group where we can pay for these things.
Yeah, exactly.
Or where we're starting to have the families where we're going to start taking them to see these movies with us. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you are agreeing with me. You know that.
I am. Right? I am. I'm just saying. But Disney has always done this because Disney is constantly re-releasing these movies.
Differences between or things that they added and stuff, like one of the things I said was sexuality was one of the biggest things that they kind of enhanced.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit more about that. How do you think they enhance sexuality in this film?
All right, so they begin it with this big ball that the prince is having, and the prince has got to be at least 18.
Yeah, this time they made the prince more
so
appropriately
they made him
aged.
Of age. So then they also made him more accountable, which right. makes him more of a fucking asshole.
Well,
when I look at that beginning scene, I'm looking at that party, I'm like, everyone's there for an orgy. This enchantress wasn't invited to the orgy and got really upset and turned them all into fucking inanimate objects so they couldn't fuck each other.
I mean, they are French, so you could be
sorry,
very
could,
right.
Yeah, zero points was that. But
this is a whole different movie.
But I mean, and then Gaston and his, what's the boy's name?
That LeFou.
Follows him? LeFou.
Played by Josh Gad.
There's added sexual undertones there.
I don't think this is like added. It's just like explicit.
It's straight up obvious.
Yeah, Josh Gad's LeFou is in love with Gaston.
Yeah.
He is gay. He is, you know, straight up just mm-hmm. a gay Disney character. That I think he might be the first for a feature film.
I think
for sure.
So. I think that Disney took the route where it's like, you know, we hinted at it before and now we're just going to tell you this is the case.
Oh, so I don't know. See, I don't think they hinted at it during the original.
They kind of did.
You think?
Yeah.
I did not read LeFou as gay growing up.
Did you read him as asexual?
Yeah.
As I mean, most I would say cartoon like, characters should be read as such, but if it's a love story and you know, people have personal attachments to each other, then
I mean,
they have
LeFou
to have
just didn't, you know, he was animated in a way that had no sexuality. He was also just like, he was like a hype man. That's how I read him, I guess. The introduction to LeFou was an interesting one, I think. I don't know why the Disney chose to go. Well, I know why, right? You need to have some representation, right? So let's do it in the most obscure way.
And that speaks so of the time today, like when I was drawing parallels to the film that came out 4 years before with Frozen and how they're changing like what was like True Love's kiss. You know, the kiss of her sister, and that was True Love. It was changing things there. You know, Disney's now also trying to change representation of two men's relationship mm-hmm. and hint at very, very lightly.
But super lightly. I mean, if you
homosexuality.
If you blink, like you don't, you miss the reveal that he's gay.
Yeah. But it's still there, and that's one of the benefits, I suppose, of remaking it, because at least now if a gay child were to see this, you blink, it's there. But if you don't blink and you see it, you still digest that.
I mean,
you see some representation of you in a really, really popular movie.
I think a gay kid would just like go towards Frozen. I would prefer Frozen over this one little blink moment.
You're the one blink of the moment though is the only time it's like almost completely explicit, but the rest of the film you're picking up on that. You can't say that you're not. You just said it yourself 2 minutes ago that it's like not something that.
Well, yeah, because like you know,
you're saying that you blink and you miss it where he like winks at a guy in the at the end of the movie it, and stuff.
Because
but also, the whole time his relationship and his aura and the way he responds to Gaston, you're still picking up on it. So no, actually, it's not the one moment.
But he was a bad guy.
What does that have to do with anything? It's about infatuation and lust and about gay representation.
Because
it doesn't matter who it is.
He was, sure, he was a bad guy that ends up getting redeemed at the end, but he was a bad guy. So kids are then watching these sexual undertones. That's called queer coding.
That's also called humanization and showing that, hey, someone out there loves Gaston. I'm agreeing with you. It is queer coding.
Okay.
But I'm also saying that they're also saying, well, he's not all bad. Someone out there actually appreciates him for him, even though he's too self-absorbed with his head up his own ass to notice this.
I feel like Disney should have just like, if you're going to make a big fuss about this, like if you're going to make a big fuss about having a gay character in your film, then make him a gay character. Don't just do it subtly.
Essentially, I do agree with you, but at the same time, I'm just thinking about the little kid that like grows up watching this and who's like gay and trying to come to terms with it and see some sort of representation of himself within LeFou. So like, I'll give Disney that much, but the rest of it is like, you know what? You know, you're not doing me any favors and you're not doing the gay community any favors.
I mean, I guess the question I would pose to that is just like, but is this film that appropriate venue to do that necessarily? Only
yes.
Because when you think about the source material. Like, are you just throwing in a gay element there for the sake of throwing a gay element?
Of course you are, but it's also like gay people existed in France in the 1800s.
Oh,
so
most
why
certainly.
Not?
That must have been like
It's not like an inaccurate depiction. And it's something that should be there because it's actually more realistic than anything. Though it's like a highly unrealistic story. So throwing in some gay people is adding some realism.
Is it? Well, fine, fair. The actual thing I will say, though, is I think LeFou's portrayal of kind of being that, you know, in love with like your straight best friend.
Yeah.
I personally could relate to that as a gay man. I think a lot of gay men growing up probably do experience this.
Yeah.
And it's a hard lesson to learn. LeFou has to learn it. A lot of these remakes that we've been watching already, you notice that they do have inclusion of people of color, at least in more significant roles. This one, as we said, Mrs. Featherbottom, again, I don't know if that's her name, but that was that character in this film. But do you think, does anything else come to mind in terms of that idea of people of color representation in this film? No, right?
I think that's
interesting, though, for, I think...
2017? Well, you know, in terms of the remake and all the newness they brought to it, I mean, all they did was added, like, they replaced animation with overly done CGI.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Right.
I mean, it's essentially the same film. They didn't change much. They actually just did a remake, a straight-up remake. Yeah. And a straight-up adaptation of the musical, which was also kind of its own version of the 1991 film. So it's the same thing. It's just got horrible CGI, overdone CGI.
Overdone CGI. Yeah, I think that was one of the biggest issues I took with this remake. I understand why you can't make like a little lamppost talk, but
yeah.
I don't understand why you had to have Dan Stevens play the Beast in CGI. Because I think... he looked so... he just didn't look real. It didn't capture properly. Yeah. I remember growing up, there used to be that TV show. I think it was Beauty and the Beast. I think it took place in the city, right?
Yes, New York City.
Okay, so I think they were like, they solved crimes under the sewers, if I remember correctly. But I remember, though, the Beast had prosthetics. And that Beast, actually, as a kid, I was like a little scared of it. Because he was kind of like, there was like this tall guy in this Beast makeup. I think he was like very lion-like. Mm. And it was kind of scary as a child. And the Beast is supposed to be scary. I feel like if I was a child watching this movie and I saw the Beast, I wouldn't be scared. I'd be like, what is that? It's confusion mostly for me. It just didn't... I don't know why Disney opted to do this all in CGI when they could have just done a mix. You know?
For sure. I mean, like, granted, they probably didn't want to have the actor under prosthetics for 5 hours. But the time that I'm more like, and it's more impressive when you see that it's a makeup job and you're like, my God, makeup artists are unbelievable and they're so amazing.
All I'm just saying is just like the use of CGI was just, I think, a little too much.
Are you kidding me? I mean, you know, Disney's castle appears. Then you pan out of the castle and then the Enchantress's hand comes into the frame. And then when I saw that, I'm like, oh, I know what I'm about to see. I'm just about to see the animators film. I'm not going to see a film. I'm not going to see a live action film. I'm going to see... maybe 28% of a film and then 80% of CGI.
Right.
And that just kind of bothers me because that's the direction movies are heading in and it's so unabashedly that. And I'm not a fan of that. It's not film. It's something new. I think there's almost like a new term that has to, like CGI movies, yeah. We should just call them or something.
Which is fair. The only thing is like this was they're adapting an animated film. So maybe this isn't necessarily the wrong medium. I just think if you're just having human actors, just stick to the human, you know, I don't have a problem with like the, like Be Our Guest scene. That was all animated. In fact,
I'm saying I have a problem when they overuse it though. Like they didn't need that scene in the beginning when the Enchantress's hand comes in and then you see her pick the rose
right.
And all that stuff. And it's like, before we even get into the plot, it's just like, ooh, let's show you what our CGI can do.
I mean,
it wasn't pivotal to the story.
It wasn't
needed.
Yeah, you know, but it's also part of the... I mean, you also got to think about this is supposed to be a 3D movie, right? So you have to have like those kinds of things, make it like super cool for the kids. And that's what they were trying to do there. I agree with you though. I think it's not a successful use of CGI.
Did you like the original and did you like the remake?
I love the original. That was one of my favorite movies growing up. I don't, this remake pales in comparison.
Yeah.
I think Emma Watson she did a fine job. I think most of the cast did a fine job. But overall, it was just like that over-reliance on CGI and kind of that exploitation of nostalgia that ultimately turns me off from this adaptation, from this remake.
You know, the reason the original, in my opinion, was made was to get back to the time period when Disney was in its heyday. And it was a successful nod to the past. And it's a nice film. I'm not crazy about it. I probably will watch it when my niece or if I ever have children watch it. But I'm not going to go ahead and say it's a masterpiece. It has flaws. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be very careful as to what age my children will be if they do watch it. But I still enjoy it. I think the music's great. Angela Lansbury singing Beauty and the Beast. I love you, baby. You're the best. I can't believe I just called 93-year-old Angela Lansbury baby.
She's still alive?
She's still alive.
This I didn't know.
Remake, I did not care for it either. You know, it was a trip down memory lane in a new, redone way, oddly enough. And that's going to get into my last point. We need this remake. I know why people craved this remake and why people rushed to see it and why it did so well. Technically, it did better than the original, but we didn't need it. And if it didn't exist, you know, our pop culture, the thing that is changing because of it is all the now live action remakes of the animation musicals of the 90s. But if that didn't exist and none of these films exist, then I don't think that it's like a defining moment of our generation.
Right. Yeah, no. Agreed, because I think, you know, there is this trend of all these remakes coming out. You know, the next ones that the ones they're currently working on are The Lion King and Mulan, I know, are definites that are coming out next in the slate.
And Aladdin.
Oh, and Aladdin. That's right. Yeah, they're remaking Aladdin. And I'm excited for them. I am, maybe because, again, I know that they're cashing out on nostalgia. I still want to see them, you know? I think they were so successful with The Jungle Book that I kind of had high hopes for Beauty and the Beast. It didn't succeed. I think The Lion King, you know, is Jon Favreau again, so I'm going to give that one a lot more. That one has a lot to write on because I love The Jungle Book so much. That was a good adaptation, and The Lion King is so good. That's, I think, my favorite Disney movie, period. And it's a lot to write on, so I don't know. This one turned me off a little bit from these Disney remakes, but I'm still a little hopeful, I guess.
One final question. This is kind of an off-the-cusp question, but if you had anything to do with the remake, would you have done anything differently?
Well, I would not. I would have, like, hired prosthetic makeup artists to work on the Beast.
Yeah.
I would have just figured out to do a blend of prosthetics and CGI, at least for the Beast. I think everything else you have to do some form of CGI. Ooh, maybe stop motion. That would have been another option.
Okay.
But I think definitely for the Beast, I would have wanted a live action human. I want Emma Watson to kind of interact with something there, physical.
Yeah. I probably would have done the same thing. I would have made the gay relationship a little bit more on the nose. I probably would have hired a French actress. I mean, it's whatever. I don't really care that none of these people are French.
Well, yeah. Emma Watson French, is not. But... Emma Watson is British and from Hogwarts, so.
She's a muggle, so. And yeah, I actually, I probably would have made Gaston more of a humane character, not so black and white.
Right.
Because that's always been an issue in both films, but whatever. I mean, it's Disney. Mm-hmm. They can't make the their villains that, what's the good word for that? Relatable or realistic. They have to completely villainize them so that you know bad guy is bad, you know. But I probably would have changed that if that was. But that's it. I just thought we would have a little fun with that because we can't do really a comparison between the two.
Oh, I was actually going to throw you some comparisons and you get to figure out who you do it. In terms of adaptation.
Lightning round.
Belle, do you like the 1991 or 2017?
Are we really doing this? I mean, like... they're pretty much the same Belle. I don't see that many differences within Belle. And I like the singer of Belle better.
Right. I think that's one of my critiques also with this film, right? Like, if you're going to hire big name actors, you should start training them or dubbing their voices like they used to do in the old days.
It's more important that they act. They know how to act than to sing.
Emma Watson, I think for...
And she's a good actress, the flaws, so I don't
the
care.
The flaws for the movie, she was actually not bad. It was just her singing was, I thought, a little that on the flat side.
That didn't bother me.
You know, I felt like the first Belle had, like, a nicer voice. Do you have a preference
That's
in the
for
Beast?
Sure. I think, overall, my preference is the 1991
yeah,
film.
Yeah, agreed. Same for me.
Yeah.
What about Gaston?
Like I just said, I think overall.
So you're just going to go with overall? I think I agree with you, though. Gaston is probably the favorite.
Say, the only thing I prefer might be Le Fou because of the added...
okay.
The realism moment of homosexuality in Le Fou.
Which is fair.
I prefer in 2017. Yeah.
You're right. We could not do this game.
This is the second time that I've preferred a Josh Gad representation in a remake.
Wow. All right. I think that's plenty on Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, that was a song as old as rhyme, so.
So I guess we're ready for some news.
Let's get some news. He is prepared.
Got some music.
All right, guys, you heard it. I'm very excited about this news. This reboot of Charm. I was a big fan of Charm when it first came out in 1998. It lasted 8 seasons. The CW announced in May, they released the preview of their new reboot of Charm in May. Supposedly, it is scheduled to be released on October 14th. And this is something I'm really looking forward to.
Did you watch Charmed growing up?
So I watched Charmed. I actually remember the first time I saw Charmed, which was a pilot episode. Oh, wow. I used to sleep in my grandma's place because, you know, she had heart problems. I had to be there to protect her. Hang on. This is important. Because she sleeps so early, I had to just stay up late and just watch TV. And I remember Charmed was like a late night TV show that was on, I think, at 9 p.m. Mm-hmm. on the WB then. Yeah, I remember watching the first 2 seasons, and I don't remember necessarily liking it, but it was enough to keep my attention. I don't know if this is a remake that I need, but I'll give it a shot, I guess.
Okay, I never watched it at all, and I have no opinions about it, but I will say that Eddie's excitement over the show is contagious.
I'm excited.
And that if there's any lesbians in this one, then I definitely will watch, because you pander to me in that way, then I'm gonna give in.
Oh, actually, Eddie, now I know you used to watch the show. Were there any lesbians in this, in the original?
In the original, no. There were
No. I would have known that, and I would have watched it.
Yeah. Okay, fair.
In the remake, or the reboot, the middle sister, Mel, she's going to be a lesbian, and she's going to be in an on-again, off-again relationship with a detective.
Oh, maybe I'll give it a try.
Oh, so okay.
Yeah, maybe I'll watch it.
I think we'll give it a chance. Maybe we'll talk about it on the show.
Yeah, maybe.
It's coming out in October, so.
All right, I guess that's it.
That's really all we have to talk about. Nicole.
That's all she wrote.
This was fun. Yeah. I think so. I think we had a great conversation. As always, thank you, Nicole.
As always, yeah. No, thank you.
And until next time, stay unoriginal.
Bam.
Got it.